It's an honor to be here with Marcus Hunter and Elijah Anderson. And my comments today, the discussion that I hope they will put on the table are necessarily interdisciplinary ones. I want to bring the dual lens of law and history into our conversation. I want to ask these two colleagues, sociologists, to talk about what for me emerges three fundamental rubrics or ways of seeing in their work, race, agency, and in listening to discussion, I want to add a third point about canons and the way in which canons shape our work and our capacity to explain the worlds we study. I was so moved by beginning with Dr. Du Bois to be reminded how, for you all, he is such an important touchstone still, because, of course, as historians, we would say the same, that we recognize him as one of still our great thinkers. And his work is still read and deeply relevant. I wondered if he'd be pleased to see us sitting here, or he'd be a bit bemused, wondering why we'd need three people when he was the embodiment of all of that, and as Marcus Hunter so importantly pointed out, that and more. So I also felt humbled by having Du Bois as the frame for our conversation. I want to end up saying a little bit about Black Matters, which I've taken to be a play on Black Lives Matter, but I'll ask that of Celia at the end. So for those of us who work in law and history, in particular working at the intersection of the two, the view of race as a social construction has been an important thread. We still cite and require our students to read Michael Omi and Howard Wynant's Racial Formation. And we can point now to a sophisticated and wide-ranging body of work that asks how race was a social construction, how that came into being over time, and how law in particular is a site for the production of ideas about race. Here I'm thinking of the work of, for example, legal historian Ariella Gross, who chronicles what she describes as trials of racial determination in her 2008 book, What Blood Won't Tell. There, Gross explains how 19th century trial courts produced ideas about blackness, Indianness, and whiteness through what Omi and Wynant would term racial formations. Litigants, judges, lawyers in the United States pointed to arbitrary differences in human bodies, skin color, hair texture, the shape of noses, the curves of calves, the moons of fingernails, and then ascribed legal meaning to such differences. We know that material consequences often resulted. A court's racial determination might decide who was a slave and who was free. People said to be Indians were free while black people were presumed slaves. Who could marry whom, those said to be white, could be barred from marrying non-whites to maintain a eugenicist vision of racial purity. And who was eligible to become a citizen of the United States. Immigration Acts in 1882 and 1924 prohibited the naturalization of Asian immigrants until the years of the Second World War. The point is not simply that race determined status or access to rights. Gross argues that legal culture produced ideas that we call race, that it poured meaning into those human differences, and that those meanings produced in law had a force in the social world. There is, however, another trend in our writing of the history of race and law, and it's one in which we assume racial categories. We treat them as logical and nearly fixed, at least for the purposes of a given study. Even Gross concedes that for most people in U.S. history, race was as she puts it, over-determined. What she means here, of course, is that there's a powerful shorthand at work in our studies, one in which questions about racial identity are never really asked. The answers are assumed based upon a common sense assessment of those differences in human bodies. So often when we write the history of race and law, we do by way of an assumption about the blackness of litigants or lawyers or communities. We know them when we see them in the archives marked as such, court records, census returns, or gathered in church congregations or political conventions. This approach is, we might say, somewhat at odds, or at least in tension, with the constructivist approach. Race here is nearly a fact, an essential rather than a social fact, evidenced in bodies and categories and in associational affiliations. Thus, in legal history, sometimes race is a question, the construction of which we study, and at other times it is a premise, one that defines the parameters of a study, but is not itself interrogated. So in our discussion this morning, I hoped we might hear more about how Hunter and Anderson see race. Might seem a rather banal question, but I think not in this room, and I'll tell you why. Last summer, I was on a scientific committee here at Paris 7 called Historians at the Margins, and our focus was on early African-American historians. And we heard papers all day about people said to be black and about their pasts, but we never spoke about the construction of race. And then our closing speaker didn't make it. And so we had 2 hours left at the end of the day, and we threw it open for a conversation. Scholars from the U.S. and scholars from France at the table, and very quickly our conversation turned to the question, what do we mean when we say race? And we learned, of course, that there was very little that was shared between us or among us when we invoked race. U.S. scholars were generally very confident that we could assume race as we moved on to explain the histories of black people. French scholars, in contrast, I think, were puzzled about how we might rely upon such an assumption. They seemed to be not at ease with relying upon differences as flimsy as skin color or hair texture or a check on a box on a census return for the premise of a study. For U.S. scholars, race was so real that we never questioned our reliance upon it to organize our research questions. For French scholars, the premise research on race, if not illegal, was certainly suspect, and perhaps even to sanction something like racism, or worse, of course, communitarianism. I won't say more or speak for the room, but I hope that this remark at least opens up a frank and illuminating exchange about what it is we mean when we frame our research in terms of race. Elijah Anderson told a story about wonderful stories about these spaces, white space, black space, cosmopolitan space. I want to tell one that was important for me in rethinking my canon. And my canon in my field of race and law is a canon that has long been premised on blackness as the thread, as the essential narrative in our narrative of race and law. It goes something like from the Constitution to Prigg versus Pennsylvania to Dred Scott, Plessy versus Ferguson, the Constitution again, Plessy versus Ferguson, Brown versus Board of Education. We have this canon of race and law, all of which is premised on the black experience as the quintessential window into race. But I had an experience that led me to want to rethink that a little bit. I was in a space that I wonder how you'd characterize it. I was on the Queen Mary II. That seems strange, but I'm going to tell you anyway. It was my husband's big birthday, and we, as we do each spring, travel between the U.S. and France to come home. And my husband is French. And as it is on these ocean liners. Is that a white space or is that a cosmopolitan? I think I thought it might be a cosmopolitan space, except I kept counting the black people. There were 37. I made 38. So I'm not sure if it was a cosmopolitan space or not, but I think it was in the sense that it was intended, the expectations that were that we would be polite, we would be civil, and as is the case in such circumstances, the maitre d' seats you at a table, a pre-assigned table, and we were at a French table. There was a French hostess on the ship, and she seated us at the French table. And so there was a couple from Mexico City who were sort of Francophiles, and there was a couple from Montpellier, young couple who had been traveling the globe and were making their way back to France by way of the Queen Mary. And there was wine and there was polite conversation, but the young man from Montpellier began to talk about his business. He was a real estate developer. I would call him a speculator, but he was a real estate developer in Montpellier. And he was renovating buildings and gentrifying neighborhoods in Montpellier, I would say. And I kind of tuned in because in a former life I had been a lawyer on the Lower East Side of New York City battling against gentrification. So I was, on the one hand, intrigued, but I was also a little repulsed, frankly. So I was half listening, but he was just to my left. And he began to describe what we might call the sociological demographics of it all, and began to talk about French people and Arab people, Muslim people, and I began to tune in a little, and he was describing a deal. A business transaction, the change of a building. And he turned to me and said, "You know, when there are Arabs involved, it all goes to shit. When there are Arabs involved, it all goes to shit." And I looked at my husband, and I said, "I think it's time to leave." because it was a nigger moment, right? Except it wasn't about black people. It was about the people of the Maghreb. And why that was such an important moment for me was that I realized that I, of course, expected in some cultural sense that he would say, right, when black people are involved, when niggers are involved, everything goes to shit. But that's not what he said. And it was an opening up for me of recognizing that in that space on the Atlantic Ocean, right, where I'm not sure where we are exactly in a sociological sense, but we're certainly in a space where my ideas about blackness as the quintessential, right, as black people as the quintessential niggers, I didn't wonder if, in fact, Arab people weren't the niggers of the world and that I needed to come home and rethink my canon of race and law to account for the ways in which over time and in our own time, people of the Arab world are now joining us in this terrible narrative that is race and law. So rethinking the canon is my second point. A last point is about agency. We are in legal history, in the history of race and law, at a moment where we are really navigating what we might think of as a swinging pendulum between, on the one hand, big histories, histories written through metaforces, through structure, like legal doctrine as linked to economics and political structures, big histories, sweeping scopes with explanatory reach over decades and continents for thinking about race and law. On the other end of this pendulum swing is what we might call the biographical turn. Here we're explaining the history of race and law through micro-histories, individuals, families, who again, over time, we argue, have the capacity to explain the history of race, but structure recedes from that. And in this work, the concept of agency has really been rethought and much maligned. On the one hand, I had one of my great professors in graduate school, Daryl Scott. I said his name just for the recording. Daryl would say to me, "Oh, old God's children got agency, Martha. There's nothing particularly analytically interesting about agency." And historian Walter Johnson, who chides us that if we're to write about agency and the agency of enslaved people, for example, we have to be prepared to write about them as liars and stealers and cheaters, as well as noble, righteous, and wrongly aggrieved heroes and heroines. Part of my work is to resist this dichotomy, I think, between structure and agency and this sort of parody, as I've laid it out, to think more about the relationship, in fact, between that lived experience, the agency of Black people in law, in my case, and the structures of law, courts, doctrine on the other end, and to wonder, to investigate, and perhaps to assert that there is a deeper relationship between those two than we've appreciated. I felt in your work that a real affirmation of that move in history, perhaps we've come to it late, but a real affirmation in the way in which your work is so grounded, in the experiences and the tellings and the explanations of experience for individuals, but always looking toward and reaching for the way that is linked to the structures that we know are present. So I'll close with just a gesture at Black Matters, and I will ask Celia to tell us why this morning was called Black Matters, and not Black Lives Matter. That's a genuine question, not a challenge. But it's to say that abstraction of Black Matters is one worth thinking about. What will be our long-term takeaway from this movement? Will it be the abstraction of Blackness? Will it be Black lives? I felt in your videos, right, sort of the insistence that we continue the focus on lives. Let lives matter, and not simply Blackness, right? As a site of study or as an abstract category, but what we might take away in our work and in our analysis is the essential dimension that is lives. I was telling Elijah Anderson that there's so much more I'd like to say, but the question I'll leave us with is, of course, that there's a counterpart, or there has been emerged a counterpart or a companion to the slogan, the important slogan that is, or the rallying cry that is Black Lives Matter, and that has been Say Her Name. Your video, of course, reminds us vividly that Black women are not outside of our urgency and our critique and our important thinking and our important activism around Black Lives Matter, that women, too, are on the front lines. And still, I did take from your work the ways in which spaces, the community of communities in Philadelphia, for example, are still highly gendered spaces. Elijah Anderson's wonderful example of this block, I think it was a block in Philadelphia, on the one hand, one side of the street, the site of what was once a farmer's market and then a restaurant, on the other side, a park, how differently those spaces are configured in terms of gender, and how, while I think Say Our Name has been essential, Say Her Name has been essential in re-situating women within the movement that is Black Lives Matter, I didn't wonder if, in fact, there wasn't some logic in our disproportionate focus on young Black men, precisely because, through your work, I read those spaces as highly gendered, and young Black men as, and their sites of sociability as particularly vulnerable to, in the specific case, to surveillance and to police violence. I'm not sure if I'm right about that, but it's certainly a question that the work provoked for me. So Black Lives, Black Matters to Black Lives Matters, to say her name is something else for us to think about. So again, I thank the three of you very much for sharing the morning with me. Yeah.